We're all a work in progress, as Mother Teresa once said.
Wise words.
Or one of those ladies, someone's mother named Teresa. And welcome everybody to episode 14 of Digesting Cinema with Aaron and Christina. As always, I am joined by my fellow host Christina, and this week we are covering pre-2000s westerns with a very, very special guest. You're soon going to know him, the masses will, but if you follow, you know, the fan leagues, he's the final member of the Fan League 4 to make his debut in the Schmodown. He's also just a great guy all the way around. His name's Jacoby Bancroft. How you doing, Jacoby?
Doing great. Happy to be here. Happy to be with you guys. We're going to have a good time. Ready to party.
Yeah. And I didn't mention yet, but the movie we're covering, I was very surprised because I didn't really have any awareness of this movie. We went way back with the pre-2000s to 1995. You know, because there's like no westerns that were made before the 90s. Like
that's when they started. Yeah.
Yeah. That's where it really started to pick up steam. 1995, Sam Raimi directed The Quick and the Dead. That's the name. It's, I believe, a remake because was specified the Gene Hackman version, so maybe there was an older Quick and the Dead. I actually didn't
look that up. There's four The Quick and the Deads. I'm not actually sure if they are remakes of each other, but there are four movies titled The Quick and the Dead. So
it's just a great title to have for a Western. It's like the perfect thing for it. So if you have a Western, this is probably, you could probably fit this title in anywhere and it'll apply to whatever movie you have.
Yeah, and in case I didn't say, I'm Aaron of Christina and the Digesting Cinema brand with Aaron and Christina. In case you didn't know, but before we jump further into this movie with our guests, over to Christina. How are you doing today? Happy Easter.
Happy Easter weekend for everyone who celebrated. I'm great. I'm so excited to be here with my fellow Schmodown star, who was my friend before we were Schmodown stars together. And then, you know, we're just going to have fun because Jacoby's a fun guy. This is such a Jacoby movie that he picked, and I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. We're always excited to talk about the movies here, regardless of if we love them or not. I definitely, when I watch these movies now, I immediately think of Christina throughout the movie. I'm like, sometimes I am like, and as I'm thinking about how I'm feeling about the movie, I'm like, how is Christina feeling about this movie? This was one I was a little bit, I'm interested to hear her thoughts on it for sure as we go on. But before we kind of get into the synopsis, which I know is Christina's favorite part, why did you overall pick this movie? Sometimes we have people who come on like last week with Robert, who never seen Juice, and that was just a really great recommendation for a blind recommendation. But I'm assuming you've seen this movie, or what's kind of your background with this movie?
Yeah, I have seen this movie before, and the reason I picked it for pre-2000s westerns was kind of twofold. The first reason I would say is because it was really hard to choose a western. When I was like, I think I was messaging Christina, just like, I want to do this one, I want to do this one, I want to do this one. Like all of them are super good, and there was a part of me that wanted to go old school, right? Pre-2000s and actually do an actual legit one of those spaghetti westerns, anything with Clint Eastwood, anything like that. But what I thought would be interesting in choosing this movie was that it's in the 90s. It's after kind of that old wave of westerns, and we got into this revisionist phase of westerns. And I thought that's just an interesting thing to examine of just how far westerns have come to this point. That's the intellectual reason of why I chose this movie. The other reason is because I freaking love Gene Hackman. I love the dude so much. He is slowly becoming my favorite actor in everything he does, and he's in this movie. And this comes after his Academy Award winning role in Unforgiven, so in another western. And this one, he gets to kind of be kind of more of a scenery chewing bad guy than Unforgiven. Unforgiven was like this complex layered individual. This one, he just gets to ham it up and have some fun. And so those are the two reasons why I chose this movie.
I would have preferred more chewing. I'll say that before we get further. I feel like he was like nibbling. He was not chewing on that scene quite as much as I know Gene could have let, but I do like the timing of this after Unforgiven for sure. And I implicitly start to trust your opinions on actors. You really launched, just to go into a real quick sidebar, but you launched my obsession of Michael Shannon. Actually, like, I watched Take Shelter. I hadn't even heard about it. I watched Take Shelter after you mentioned Take Shelter to people this weekend when Twister came up, because I'm like, have you seen the real good Tornado movie? I watched Nocturnal Animals this morning. I think subconsciously because I knew I was about to be talking to you, another Michael Shannon movie. So maybe Gene Hackman will be the next one.
I hope so.
Yeah, there's a lot of actors that we're going to get into all of them. I think that's one of the most parts of this movie that's aged better than anything. I mean, by far, besides the main lead, whom, no offense. But anyways, Christina, back into the fold here. Me and Jacoby will remove ourselves from our room. Hi, didn't see you there.
All right. So, as always, guys, your synopsis from IMDb, which I am saying correctly today. A female gunfighter returns to a frontier town where a dueling tournament is being held, which she enters in an effort to avenge her father's death.
Sometimes the synopsis, I'm like, oh, that doesn't quite get into it all.
That covered it.
Straightforward to the point.
Gives away a little bit of a spoiler there. You know, with the
father. Because we didn't really find out her reasoning until pretty much the end of the movie. So,
no. Which is weird. I know we'll talk about later on about like the problems with it, but like that part is just, I think, was fumbled with this movie.
Okay. Yeah. I think there's a few things that were fumbled in, but I think the first spot that makes sense to start with this movie is essentially for me, this is Mortal Kombat with gunfights. like, they're just all these different characters, some of them slightly offensive, maybe the character who believes that he can't be killed by bullets. What does he say? I didn't write it down, but like, I don't know. I think he's
literally
like,
lists like every place a bullet has like grazed his body or like
I've been shot six times in the chest, one in the head, just like last like thing. It's like,
yeah, like just yesterday I was shot.
Yeah, and his name is Spotted Horse. It's like we've got Spotted Horse, we've got Ace, we've just got, I mean, it is Mortal Kombat in the Wild Wild West almost. Like, we've got the kid played by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Listen, I'm gonna just interrupt you right now. We got like 90s peak hotness right now from Sharon Stone, Russell Crowe, and Leonardo DiCaprio. Like, I was pumped about, and you guys know I always like to comment on the hotness of the actors and actresses that we get to see. Okay, we were all there for my sexual awakening for Val Kilmer, but let me tell you how much I love a 90s Leonardo. Like, I love him. I was obsessed with him. Titanic was my jam. And then I remember at the book fair at school, there was like a Leonardo DiCaprio book that I owned and read several times. Okay. So I know like deep, intimate things about Leonardo DiCaprio based off of his biography I bought at the Scholastic Book Fair.
It's amazing though. You think this is peak hotness, Leo, for you? This is like young, this is baby face, Leo.
It's the hair. This is peak Leo hotness. Sharon Stone, smoke show. And she wasn't even like that hot in this movie. And she was still a smoke show.
Just, you know, for legal purposes, Leonardo DiCaprio, 21 years old. At 21. The time
I looked film. It up before. I looked it up before I started talking. I wasn't trying to be a creeper.
Yeah, I'm just saying, who am I to judge?
I wasn't like, oh man, and what's eating Gilbert Grape when he was 14 years old?
And I will agree with you. Russell Crowe has never looked better than in this movie. He is.
Yeah,
this
it was before all the booze.
Like, yeah, before all the booze, he got really jolly.
If we're talking about hotties, Robert Blossom of, you know, Home Alone fame, the shoveler from Home Alone is in this movie.
Is that the old guy from Home Alone?
Yes, it is.
In a weird role where you're just like, oh, is he a ghost? Nope, he's actually there, but he was a ghost in that one scene, but then actually there, it doesn't know what to do with this guy.
Yeah, really, it's all, I mean, Lance Hendrickson, I loved him as Ace. So I'll get to one of my cast members who didn't work for me. And it was especially when she started talking. Sharon Stone's Ellen. I don't know if she was the right person for this movie. And I've done a lot of research into kind of the making of this movie. I know she was such a huge role and she was a producing member on this movie, which is, I think, amazing for her to kind of take her big role from, you know, Basic Instinct and whatnot and like really take control of her, like her acting and producing. I thought that was really great. And, you know, she was a big key in Russell Crowe and Leonardo DiCaprio getting casted, which at the time was not the slam dunk it is now. I mean, this movie, looking at it through like 2020 goggles, is a completely different movie than when it was made at the time. So like, she definitely had an eye for talent. It's just, she just was a little bit, especially in certain scenes where she decided to get like her hair blown out, like for certain duels, she was like coming out of like a music video. I was just like, wow, she didn't look like she was in a Western exactly. It was a little bit too clean.
Looked fantastic.
She did look fantastic. She showed her breasts, which I always support for, you know, whatever reason. Like, it was the weirdest kind of like sex scene too. I know we're jumping around here, but obviously the sex scene for me with Russell Crowe, I thought was really weird overall. Didn't need to really be there. And then she's like lifts her like button up shirt up just to like show off her rack. I was like, all right, like it's all good. Like, cool. But yeah, what were your thoughts kind of on Sharon Stone? Am I kind of alone in that? Like, I just feel like there's a few other kind of leading ladies who in the mid-90s could have kind of nailed this better.
I think, at least for me, it's tough because the character she's playing is supposed to be just this enigma, because that's kind of what in Westerns your main character normally is, right? It's just your cowboy, your main person. I mean, like, she's really not, she's named Ellen, but it's like really she's called the lady. She's supposed to be just this singular person who just goes in without any backstory, without a whole lot of motivation or driving anything. It's just a force, right? That's how like all the Westerns were before, and it's kind of what they're doing here, but I don't know if they tie that in well with like once you find out what her motivation is. It's just, I think the reason her character doesn't work for me is because it's inconsistent with how much she wants to kill and how much she does not want to kill, because she comes into town thinking like, I'm going to kill Herod, I'm going to kill him no matter what, and I want to sign up, let's duel right now. But then she kind of starts doubting whether or not, you know, she like wants to kill, because she kills Tobin Bell, Jigsaw, who's in a random role, and then she kills that rapist in the rain. She's like, I don't want to be here, I can't do this, I'm not this person who can go in and kill somebody. I just think that character arc just made it tough to, I guess, root for her in a sense of just like understand where she was coming from. That's what hindered her character for me. Her performance was fine because when she was mean and growly, that's kind of what she was supposed to be, but I don't know.
Yeah, when she didn't talk, I loved it. When she was just like a lady, I thought it was great. It like when she like starts to over emote in the rain, like she's like screaming as she has to kill somebody. I'm like, wait, are you this like kind of strange killer badass woman, or are you like
punch the kid in the face?
That's true. She did punch the kid in the face. I love her introduction with Pat Hingle, who Commissioner Gordon from the early Batman movies, like him where he's just like, the horrors are next door, and she's like, say that again. Like, that introduction was awesome for her.
Perfect. Right? It was great.
And like, I just wish it would have been a more of a silent kind of terrible as that sounds, I just wish she would have been more quiet.
That's why I love Westerns. That's why I wish this movie would have, and that's why it's hard making a 90s Western, because you got to have a protagonist that's more active. But usually, like, even like you go all the way back to The Searchers with John Wayne. He was a guy who came in there. He's like, he's there, he fixes the problem, and then he leaves. That's like the role of the cowboy in these sort of things. They're not really that invested. They show up, everybody else has all the drama, all the emotion, all that stuff, and then the cowboy goes off because he can't settle. And I wish they would have adapted that a little bit more in this movie, but they couldn't.
What were your thoughts?
I feel like, and this might not necessarily be a Sharon Stone critique as it is like a movie critique, it seemed like a lot of people wanted Gene Hackman dead and like had ample opportunity to do so outside of the duel. And I just felt like there were just plenty of times where like you guys were just talking or like chilling at dinner.
But it's just the money aspect, the power that he had over these people to control. I mean, they talk about with the duel, it's $123,000 jackpot for the duel. So if you get that five pointer, there you go, you know. But it's like they specifically mentioned it's Mr. Harrod and Wells Fargo that are supplying the money, so he's connected with Wells Fargo. There's like, I'm not saying this movie has a lot of social commentary in it, because I don't think it does, but I think that's just like a little kind of hint at how banks just are, you know, interwoven into control of a town from the get-go. So it's like this guy was connected. I'm sure after this movie's over, there's hell to pay for what happened to him in this duel. I just don't think that they kill him and now they're left alone to be like just a good old fashioned town now. Like, there's just another one who comes in, another Mr. Fargo or something. So
that's one of my favorite lines too, about like why people do it at the duel, basically, is because when he says, that's what made me really like him as a villain, when he says, I do this and I enter the link because everyone does want to kill me. Like, everyone does, but now if I do it this way, it gives them an opportunity to, so people don't shoot me in the back. And because that's a lot of what Westerns are, because you said a lot of people had ample time to kill someone, but in Westerns and stuff, honor is a huge thing. It's like if you shoot somebody in the back, you're nothing. That is a garbage human being. And a lot of the good people in this would never do something about that. It's got to be honorable. So like, I like how he set up this competition to like face his enemies in an interesting way, because he's so confident in his abilities to win. And that's what made me respond to him, I guess, as a villain overall, as the setup, as this Mortal Kombat, as you say, of a movie with just a bunch of unique characters going at it.
Yeah, it's a perfect way to sell it. It really is. Mortal Kombat with guns would get so many more people to seek this movie out and watch it. And, you know, I think that the next spot to kind of go to, I mean, like, we get like established the whole town. It's hard to not see kind of just it remind you of some, it, like, this movie reminded me a lot of Westworld, for example, just overall. It felt like a like part of Westworld where, like, I like the style of Sam Raimi and how he directs and everything, but it also, I don't think what they were going for in this movie was realistic Western. So it just like, it was like very clean. Everybody kind of just looked like they were playing cowboy. Like that was okay, but it took some getting kind of used to, I guess, for me. As
Aaron, you're saying someone getting shot and then doing a flip backwards from being shot isn't realistic to you?
Everybody had a different reaction to getting shot. Some people had holes put in them. Some people had a good shot.
In typical Sam Raimi format, there was a lot of over the top, the zooming in, the slow mo that wasn't like super slow mo, wasn't Zack Snyder slow. It was just normal slow. Yeah,
thank God this movie was not 4 hours long.
Yeah,
and that's what I love about Sam Raimi. He's like, he's kind of a goofy director. Like he likes fun. And that's why I think it sets it apart from other Westerns. Like this one is like trying to be fun. It's trying to see the joy of just like, hey, these kooky characters shooting at each other in quick draw formats. It's like, let's have some fun with it. Let's have holes, like literally clean through people, like everything for this. Like they could have played this completely seriously and it more or less maybe would have been the same movie, but everything. But it's just like, it's just those type of flourishes that just like, man, this is what makes it stand out, at least for me.
Yeah, no. And I think, yeah, it's a very simple movie. It's like, oh, that's it. Like, yeah, that is. It's pretty, you know, on the surface, but it definitely paying homage to a lot of B-level Westerns for sure and giving it that 90s lens. I really loved the montage during the duel where they just kind of had the different side guys who you never really got to know how they die, like, and how that was shot. That style just, I think, is just like really, really cool to see out of Sam Raimi for sure. Like, and it's just, I think that you get informed a little bit on some of the characters through these duels when they do give them kind of that shine and how it's shot during those duels. I mean, going from the eyes to the clock back to the eye really, I think, has been influential on other movies where this kind of scene has taken place. Like, I do think it was very, very stylish, and I did appreciate that for sure. And it's just, I don't think it was a movie where it was about like the surprises exactly. Like, it's like we all knew Court, played by Russell Crowe, is eventually gonna have to kill. What were your kind of highlights of the early parts of the duel?
Well, once you saw how cocky Leonardo DiCaprio's character was, like early on, I was like, oh, well, he's eventually going to die. Like,
Which is one of my favorite parts.
Look at this cute baby. You just want to squish his face and love him. And then he's just like, I'm so fast. Like, seriously, how am I possibly this fast? Is anyone ever going to be as fast as I am?
Can I get any more perfect? Like, yeah.
I love this movie. I love you. Like, I'm telling you guys, peak hotness. If you have not watched this yet, this is it. This is Leonardo at his peak. If you were into him in Titanic, you ain't seen nothing yet. The hair flow was getting it in this movie. But I loved him. I loved his character. I loved the cockiness. And I love that it's a very weird dynamic. These people are so excited to participate in an event where somebody dies. And they're like very pumped about participating in it. And part of it is like, they're confident that they're that good, that they're not going to be the person that dies.
But they have to kill somebody.
Like... And they're okay with that. Like, it's like a very, like, it's when you really... And then the whole town just like watches, like they don't have anything else better to do. Like, all right, well, there's another duel today.
Yeah, this is all we're going
to
do.
Hold on, guys. We got to stop our meeting because, you know, someone's about to get, you know, knocked off in the alleyway.
They have a March Madness style bracket.
It's great.
They have a whole 16 seed. They're like, oh, here we go. Like, setting up the big matches for
later.
Because
originally it wasn't till the death. It was just that you had to make it so the other person wasn't standing up. So you didn't have to fatally shoot them. You just had to shoot them at a point where they were no longer standing.
And that's what I really kind of love about this movie, about Leonardo DiCaprio and about Herod himself overall, is because he changes the rules. Because really, I think at his core, Herod is a hypocrite, right? Like, he changes the rules a lot to suit him. And like, you find out that he does all these things to kind of tamper, to adjust, to go things about that. And I think that's very apparent in the cockiness of Leonardo DiCaprio. Because I think if you can compare Leo's character with Lance Henriksen's Ace character, they're very similar characters in a sense, right? Because Ace is this cocky braggart who's a lot of fake. And what does Herod do? Herod hates him for that. He guns him down in the street, which I'm not even sure if it was the proper duel time. Like, that was unclear for me. But he hates that guy for being a braggart and for being cocky about that. But then he's very similar to Leonardo DiCaprio, who's also a braggart, who's also, I'm the best at what I do. This is great. All that stuff. But how does Gene Hackman kind of respond to that? He doesn't try to shoot him down. There is a part of Gene Hackman that seems to care about him, who tries to like, hey, lay off, kid. Stop doing this. And I think that ultimately ties into how much Herod actually cares about the kid, is that he didn't just shoot him for being cocky like he did. action immediately.
Well, he couldn't though, because that's his kid.
Yeah, isn't like, Leonardo DiCaprio his son?
It's like
it that, is,
and it's one of my favorite. It's one of my favorite side plots of this movie is kind of his denial of taking responsibility for his kid, and now it's like the end tragic. Like it's like a Shakespearean tragedy by the end of it. Romeo, you know, here taking on another Shakespearean tragedy. It's like
another peacockness of Leonardo.
Very this old mid-90s is just, you know, good Leo time.
No, and that's what I'm saying, because like he doesn't take responsibility. Yeah. He never outright says he doesn't take responsibility, but like a part of him for not shooting Leonardo DiCaprio dead in the street like he did with Ace kind of shows that yes, he does in a sense know that this is his kid and he does not want to kill him, which I just think is just really cool in the big scheme of things.
Yeah, and it just it really does lead to, I think, the best dramatic moments of the movie when they're duel at the end. You know, we'll kind of jump back, but I think it's just like that the only way that the kid is going to prove that he is Herod's kid is by getting killed by him or killing him. Like it's just like Star Wars level, just like tragedy of a father son here in this like movie where most of it had some moments of heaviness. It tried with Ellen or the lady and going back to Gary Sinise and how that happened, but that was pretty expected and spelled out. It's even in the synopsis. So this part with Leonardo DiCaprio was like my most like pleasantly surprised dramatic moments of the movie, like that whole duel. It wasn't like exactly dramatic what happens with the other duel, how they like fake to death. It's like we all knew they're it's just like we all knew. Like I don't usually figure out stuff before it happens, but I figured this one out with like the red ink and everything, like the blind merchant, like she's like what kind of ink. I was like obvious, like that's clearly red ink, like they show it. I'm like there's no bullet wound, like,
and there's a shot of him like when she comes back, like the blind person dumping it out, holding red ink, like, just in case you didn't get it, folks. It's red ink.
That's like Sam Raimi, like all over it there, where it's like subtle, like dramatic moments with this like over the top, like we're gonna make this like a serial western, basically. Like,
and that's why I like, I love this movie, but I also like you can criticize it for that because that sort of thing is so obvious. But like what that kind of does is position everybody to have a good role in the finale, I guess, overall, because it gives, because obviously Leonardo DiCaprio couldn't kill Herod because it's not his fight, basically, and it's a dramatic show. But he did the best thing that he could that ended in the best way possible of injuring Herod and making Herod just be like, oh man, this is never happened, and giving that more dramatic weight. And then in that final thing between Court and the lady, basically, it gives Court the opportunity to take out all the men all around him to do all that stuff to establish that, yeah, he should be sheriff, as opposed to the lady who gets her final duel with Herod. So I like how this movie sets up everyone to be in the best spot possible to have kind of a cool character arc. So even though that, yeah, I like that.
That's a great, a great argument. Yeah, what kind of, Christina, I know that Leo was your boy. How did you feel kind of about his fateful end here?
I agree with Jacoby, and you knew he wasn't going to be the one that was going to take out Gene Hackman, because up until then, I believe we were hinting to the fact that Sharon Stone character had something to do with Gene Hackman as a child.
Yeah.
We didn't totally know exactly what it was, but you kind of knew that like something had happened to her in the past. She really wanted to kill him, and like that's how movies work. Leonardo DiCaprio is not going to. And it also goes with a similar trope of, all right, here's the cocky kid thinking he's so amazing. He's going to take down the old timer to just see that the old timer really is as good as he is. Yeah, no, it was still a bummer. And I felt so bad because his whole cockiness was like, yeah, I'm going to do this duel. Like, I'm amazing. I'm not going to die. And then once he realizes he is shot, he's just crying. Like, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. And then it's like
gut shot, like a slow gut shot.
Yeah. Right. And it's like, that's what you guys are literally signing up to do. You have a 50% chance. And actually, you know, both of you could kill each other.
There was no grace in his death. It wasn't like a thing where he gets shot and it's like, and like his final line wasn't like, shit, that was fast. And then he dies and like, that's it. Or like if he's shot, he's like, I got him. And then he dies. Like no, he's literally begging not to die. Like so much. And he's crying. He's doing, cause like, it just hurts. It's the brutality of what makes Westerns, I think, so great. I think that's the one moment of this movie where it's like, that's true to the spirit of what Westerns really are. It's that moment right there when he's like, I don't want to die. Did I get him? And I think she lies, right? She says like, yeah, you got him. But then he walks up. So like, he doesn't die even thinking that he did it. He sees him there. And the last thing he's doing is reaching out for some sort of respect. And I think a lesser movie would have had Herod like at least touch his hand, at least do something to acknowledge that, yes, I respect you as a person for doing this. And then he can die. Nope, he doesn't get any of that. He just dies horribly, and that's it.
Yeah, making him really think he denied him as his son down to his last moment. Like, he never gives him that. And I agree that is, like, the only part of this where it goes to that, like, brutal Western. Part of me would have liked to see a movie where it keeps that tone throughout. I know that's not Sam Raimi's movie to probably direct, but at the same point, a serious duel movie doesn't exist that I'm aware of. When I saw that peak part of the movie, which I feel is one of the peaks of this movie, be so different from the rest of the movie, it made me kind of remorseful that I didn't see more of that movie, I guess, if that makes sense. So, I mean, like, but it's part of what Sam Raimi's deal, you know, he does kind of shift back and forth. And this is Spider-Man Sam Raimi. I know that Leonardo DiCaprio was one of the rumors for Spider-Man back in the 2000s. And this makes complete sense. Like, he could have been, was Peter Parker in the West here, like, essentially just like this cocky young, like, and it's just like, you can see how Sam Raimi was going to be able to, it makes sense why Sam Raimi got that role of directing the Spider-Man movies.
Well, Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire are real life BFFs. Just saying.
I think they're part of a posse of some sort that I won't say on the podcast here, but yeah. So I guess we'll focus on the lady a little bit here. I think she should have been called the lady. I don't remember her being called Ellen at any point.
Yeah, I think lady, I thought they just called her lady.
Yeah, I think lady, it does make complete sense. You know, again, I loved her introduction there, and then she's kind of set up with Court, which I thought was a little bit of a weird romantic subplot that I didn't quite need, honestly.
I have thoughts about that, because what I think, because again, I chose this movie not because I'm so in love with it. I love it because there's a lot of elements I like, and there's a lot of problems with it. I think I even rewatched it for this. And I think while rewatching this, I think what would have made this movie about 10 times better to kind of tie into her, Court, if Court was there when her father died. I think if Court was actually part of that posse that Gene Hackman was a part of, and he was at least a bystander, because it's hinted at, it's that he's known Herod for a while, that he's kind of been with him, that he rose him up for that. But then that kind of gives the lady a bigger hurdle to go over, because it's about, instead of her being afraid to kill, it's about forgiveness, right? Because, like, sure, Herod doesn't deserve forgiveness because of what he did, because he's not sorry. But if Court was part of it and he's trying to give up his life of violence, and maybe he did took that vow of being a preacher because of kind of what they did or something like that, and then the lady forgiving him for that at the end, I think that would have made a much stronger character arc for the lady and even Court going forward. At least that's my thoughts about that.
Completely agree. Kind of what were your thoughts, Christine, on overall the lady and her relationship with Court? Like, is that just an inevitability of women in 90s movies? Is that damn possibly?
I didn't even care about that part. Like, it was like they were together because it was like, oh, we're like the only attractive people here.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? I didn't feel like there was any real reason for them to be together. They both seemed like they had two totally different.
I just think it could have explained without that romance. Maybe that's just me being right.
I think if there was no romance in there, it's the same movie. You know, like, it doesn't, in my opinion, it didn't really.
Like, it didn't, like, make their final duel when they're in the final four. It's like, oh, Court and the lady have to go against each other. What's going to happen here? Like,
right.
It's like they're yelling at each other, like, you have to kill me. No, you have to kill me. Like, I don't know.
Maybe that's the problem of, because I love, again, all these, the Mortal Kombat tournament. Now you got me hooked on saying it like that. Like, all these characters, it kind of robs the movie a chance to kind of establish a relationship between the lady and Court to really care for it. Because, again, that sex scene is random. Which version? Because I think if I remember, there's like a version of the movie where it has that cut out. Like, that's not.
Oh, I got the sex scene version included in mine, which I just, it was such a weird sex scene.
It's just really oddly aggressive. But, like, there's other version where that's kind of cut out, I think, to, like, probably to keep it less of a rating thing or something. But it's like, if you cut that out and, like, don't have them as, like, lovers, but have them as just as, like, respect for each other, both wanting to get away from Herod and to end Herod's reign, then that works much better than just falling in love with each other.
Yeah, like, I'm not this person who, like, overly criticizes where it's like, but, like, in this case, this is, like, one of those movies where it feels like that critique was made for, like, it's like, oh, Sharon Stone couldn't just, like, not kiss the hot man and just, like, be your own person throughout the whole, like, it's just, I just, like, question then, like, yeah, that duel and, like, setting up for that duel where she's like, I mean, maybe they weren't trying to hide that foreshadowing when she's like, what kind of angst do you have? Like, and I mean, they,
but, like, she's introduced as such this like strong woman who like doesn't take crap from anybody. So then for her to just be like, oh, but now I'm so in love. Like, it's just like not needed.
Right. It's just like, are you a badass or aren't you?
Right.
Like- and to a point to that, because like, as you said, like she's introduced as a badass, but something I really hated is that like she's a badass, but she's like not a badass because she doesn't kill. But Court has to tell her, right? Or like Court gives her the hint in her first duel of just like, wait for the click. Like the click is what gives it away. So it's him helping her to overcome the first obstacle. And that's kind of, and I wish that wasn't the case. I wanted her to be the one just to be like I'm fast enough without knowing a clue that somebody else gave me. But I guess that's not the point of her character. She's supposed to not be as strong enough on her own until the end where she's fast enough to kill Herod. It's like, you're not fast enough. And then he said, she's like, today I am. Like,
yeah, three duels later, I'm better. It just took it's like, you know, a team in the NCAA tournament, like UCLA. It just took them a couple games to get going. And all of a sudden now they're just, you know, she's the Cinderella story, I guess. Exactly. Apparently.
You do know UCLA. Like, didn't they lose?
Yeah, well, they just lost. But, you know, it's like, it's not complete. Okay. But, you know.
Yeah. Didn't they lose in like an overtime buzzer beater?
Yeah, it was like a half-court shot. It was great. Great play. Stay tuned for Digesting Basketball coming next year. Also, I want to mention this before we move on. I was like, this score is incredible. Alan Silvestri. So that makes complete sense. This is just, I know he's been in a lot of comic book movies. I know that much. I've heard that. I've read that name before. I did think that the music really played well into kind of Sam Raimi's like direction in this movie. It like was dramatic when it needed to be. It was a little bit more like spaghetti Western hokey at points. But yeah, I really liked the music.
I agree. Called back to the past stuff really well, but also making it its own kind of like, oh, this is a fun movie like type thing.
And it is fun. I know that I've also just enjoyed being able to talk with you about the honest criticisms of this movie while still like coming across that this is a very fun movie. I'd recommend it to anybody. I'd enjoy watching it again with somebody. Keith David was my favorite random side character, so I didn't exactly follow how he was like set up to be the hitman to kill. Like, I didn't like get why he was any better than any of the other gun. He seemed completely the same as the rest of them, just like, but for some reason, like when Gene Hackman or Herod was like, I know you guys sent this guy to kill me specifically. It's like, I didn't get why he was this specific guy.
Because he killed 17 men. He was a badass. He has my favorite line in the whole movie. When it's like, because in the scene where you have to introduce everybody, right? To like get all their names on the board and stuff. And then he's like Sergeant Clay Cantrell. And he's like, how do you spell that? And he's just zooming close correctly. Like,
yes. That whole scene is so great. Like, what's your name? Guy with scars? Oh, scars. Got it. Like, and it's just like, that's Mark Andrew Boone or whatever his name. But like, just like a character. Yeah, Lance Hendrickson's Ace. That whole scene was great.
It's because Ace is introduced as kind of like the bad at first, right? Because like, that's what makes Ace so great. Because after she has that great introduction with Pat Hingle at the bar, like the door opens, you see that really long shadow, and then Ace comes strolling in like he's the hot shot, like he's hot shit, and he has like all these cards and stuff. Like, it's like, oh, this guy is going to be our main, this is our antagonist who's going to be someone of importance. And the movie subverts that by having him not involved, which is just, it's just awesome. I love it.
Yeah, no,
put an Ace on the board, they'll know what it means. Like, I don't know, you want me to draw an Ace, what do you want me to do?
Yeah, when he's trying to impress Sharon Stone, he's like, do you want to play poker with me? And she's like, looks like you're having plenty of fun playing with yourself. You know, so it's like, we've got lots of just good little side one-liners throughout this movie. Quick one-liners, you know, obviously doesn't dive into a lot of these characters, nor does it need to. And I think that you make a good point. By the end, the characters who are left all play a really important role in the conclusion of the movie. So is there anything else, Christina, that you want to cover overall?
No, the ending made me so sad. So I'm like mentally preparing to talk about it now.
Well, let's go ahead and get into it. You want to tee us up for kind of the climax of the movie?
Okay, so this part was like, this was a bummer. When I watched it, I was like, oh no. Like, that's how I reacted. We kind of got a little tease that something happened when she was a child that involved Gene Hackman's character. We don't really see much, you know, just typical things in movies where you get like the pieces of the flashback. And then we finally see that her dad is about to get hanged. Gene Hackman and his men are forcing her to watch it happen. He's begging them not to. And Gene Hackman hands her the gun and says, well, you get three tries, you know, shoot him down. And, you know, it's, I can't do this, Dad. I can't do this. And he's like, yes, you can. Yes, you can. And it's, you know, the back and forth. And he's like, it's okay. You know, I believe in you kind of situation. And she shoots him in the head and kills her dad. And I was like, oh my God. Because it totally brings you back to the beginning of the movie where she saves Russell Crowe from getting hanged, like shooting him down from the rope, which I thought that was that's just excellent filmmaking right there when things come back full circle. But it was just like, you know, just, oh my God. You know, I literally, like, I gasped out loud. Just, you just assume she's going to miss. Like, I thought her trope was going to be, you know, I couldn't save my dad and this is why. And I didn't think that she was actually the one that did it.
Yeah. No, I thought that she was going to save him and then he was going to be like, all right, hang him back up, do it anyway. Like,
yeah, do it again.
It's like, you were, wait a minute. Like, definitely didn't think it was going to be the option they went with, which was just bullet to the head.
Bullet to the head. First try, too. It wasn't like a, oh, one, oh, you're super close. Two, oh, you're super close. Three in the head. It's like, no, first shot, headshot.
Yeah. Like,
right. Right.
That's
yeah.
That's hard to get over.
Of like a miss. It was just boom. You just shot him.
Like, oh, you almost hit me, honey.
Aim a little higher, please. No, but when you say it like that, it's like that does make me rethink of how much I do like that, how much Sharon Stone's reluctance to be a killer is so important, I guess, throughout the whole movie. Because, you know, the last person she killed her dad, you know, by shooting him in the head. So maybe she's a little hesitant, first time she touched a gun. Exactly. About hesitant about taking a life, so, which makes her drive. And it's like, I want to kill Herod, but I'm also afraid to kill is actually a pretty interesting character arc from start to finish. So I maybe take back what I said before about her character arc not working in a certain way, because I guess when you frame it in that context, it works pretty well.
I would be interested to actually rewatch this with all of the knowledge and see how it would affect.
I almost feel like they gave us that piece of information about her too late, because it's like there's like 10 minutes left in the movie by the time we know this major thing about her.
If you start off the movie with even, that's a brutal way to start off a movie. If you start off with a flashback, she kills her own dad, and then you know right away how much killing does for her, like how much she does not want to kill again, and you know where her fear comes from, but how much she wants to kill Herod. That just, I think that's a great idea, Christina, because that would make the movie better than it was, because then you at least understand what's driving her. Instead of a twist of like, oh, she killed her dad, that's why everything else makes sense. Instead of just like, oh, I understand exactly what's driving her and exactly what makes her interesting going forward.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, great point.
Can we talk about our love for Gene Hackman?
Yeah, Gene Hackman section begins now.
No, yes. I think this is the first Gene Hackman movie I've ever watched.
What?
Oh, I know.
He's been in 700 movies.
I know. While you two are talking, I'm going to scroll through his filmography and just to confirm. But I was thinking about that too. I was like, man, I don't think I've ever watched like a Gene Hackman movie.
That's wild. So, not even Welcome to Mooseport. Yeah, Jacoby, you know, what performances of Gene Hackman were funneled in this besides Lex Luthor, obviously?
I've seen that.
and Unforgiven. Like, obviously, this is like Lex Luthor taking over his Unforgiven character. Do you see any other shade?
Yeah, I see shades of, in a way, Mississippi Burning, where he plays like a good cop, but just because, but the way he's just like kind of fun, kind of goofy in that movie, just like, I just kind of want to see what's up, see what's happening. Like, what's going on here? Like, that sort of performance. He brings that here, but as a bad guy, just like, yeah, no, court doesn't need another bullet. He only needs one. Like, let's just see what happens here. So I think he brought all those shades into this form to make something really cool. Because he's both, and I want to go back to what you said before about him not at the top of this episode about him and maybe not going full on as hammy as he should have been, which I agree. Because I think he could have let loose a little bit more. But I like sort of those instances, like his monologue that wasn't necessary, but just to flesh out his character about why he's never afraid is because his father and his mother made him play Russian roulette until his father blew the back of his head out. And the way he gives that line just kind of laughs and chuckles at it, like it blew his back of his head off. So I'm not afraid of anything. It's just awesome. It's like, I love that performance. Or when he's yelling at the town, it's like, this is who you sent to kill me, this Keith David guy, you don't get it. It's like, I don't understand, I thought you guys were poor. Like, just
yeah, he definitely serves his role perfectly, you know. And I am gonna have to go through Gene's filmography after this and pick out a Gene movie for tonight. So maybe it will be Mississippi's Burning. I haven't seen that in a long time, so
I think he's really good in that movie.
Yeah,
any movie, Gene Hackman's great. Gene Hackman, if you're listening to this, I think you're great.
Yeah, Gene, definitely. If you're listening, you're welcome to come on and discuss any of your movies or any other movies too. Yeah.
Did you guys know for the Gene Hackman performance, when he slaps Sharon Stone with the glove across her face, that was unscripted. He did that improvised, and her reaction to that is real. So he was really intense in that, and it's probably kind of problematic that he just chose, like, yeah, I'm going to hit her across the face.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
It's a common theme of movies Aaron and I have watched in digesting cinema, where women just get the crap kicked out of them.
Yeah. I think at least in half of the movies we've watched so far this year, a woman has been slapped by a man.
Yes.
Sometimes close-fisted, which is known as a punch. But anywho, any other final thoughts?
I just want to point out that I have seen four other Gene Hackman movies, and I wrote them down.
Yes.
Young Frankenstein, nice. Superman, nice. Ants, and the cinema classic starring Sigourney Weaver and Jennifer Love Hewitt, Heartbreakers.
Oh my God. All right. Four down, 72 more to go.
Pretty much.
So yes. You can put Gene Hackman as your slice for next match. So that's great.
We'll put it right there
with Robert Redford. Wink nudge. So anyways, we're on to our rating section of the podcast. It's definitely, I think, that one that's going to be harder to rate after this conversation. Often after these conversations, I do find my admiration for movies goes up a little bit, but I do try to make my rating pre-conversation. That's why I gave Blair Witch Project a 2.5 when it was a 7 out of 5 after the podcast. But I guess I'll start for Quick and the Dead. I'm going to give this a flat 3 out of 5. I was expecting to like this a little bit more than I ended up liking it initially when finishing it. I did find it very stylized, and I really enjoyed aspects of it, but a little bit of me felt like, it left me wanting just a little bit more of something. I was like, that was it. But yeah, that was kind of it. It was a play on, 50s B-movie level Westerns, which, aren't my exactly favorite kind of Westerns either. So that was maybe more my own expectations, but it's like the style alone and the music and just, there's so much talent in this movie and throughout the cast. It's really, it does make the movie, viewing it afterwards, much more of something to kind of be marveled at. Sam Raimi, you're really seeing a lot of his, style that gets used in so many of these bigger movies really getting used here. We'll leave our guest for last. So Christina, your rating out of 5.
I'm going to go for a 2.5 because I thought parts of this were like a little boring, because I was like, why are we just, we're just killing each other. And then like it finally like picks up, and then like the movie ends where I was like, all right, I'm into this. Like my poor baby Leonardo. And then I was like, oh, this is why Sharon Stone wants to kill this dude. That makes sense. And then like the movie just ends. It's a very abrupt ending. And I also just feel like Sam Raimi probably was just not the guy to make a Western. I just felt like there are parts that seemed like, I find him just corny, and I love the Spider-Man movies, but like I find him corny. Okay. And I have a hard time with that. And I understand like the whole 90s were corny, but like he's corny. So this is going to be a corny 2.5 stars.
That's actually is the perfect word for some of Sam Raimi's corny. Some of his corny sometimes works really well. Like I think like Army of Darkness, and then other times, maybe not so much.
All right, Jacoby, it's out of 5 stars, by the way. Half stars are allowed, same as Letterboxd.
I am torn between two. I think I'm going to, it's either a 3.5 or a 4 for me. I think I'm actually going to go 4 out of 5 stars. Not because again, as I've talked about, I have a lot of problems with the plot, and kind of the story and like how it kind of presents it. Like I didn't do that. But I think what the cast elevates it, and I think the idea of having this Western in the 90s that kind of calls back to a lot of the spaghetti Westerns, the Clint Eastwood ones, everything back then, and the way that it adapts it for the 90s and making this sort of a Mortal Kombat movie with a lot of interesting characters going out, where you're just like, man, I kind of want this character to win against this character. I think the format of that, of the way that it, sorry to be long-winded here, I guess, but it's like the way that in those spaghetti Westerns, all the, like, especially the Clint Eastwood ones, like the Good, the Bad, the Ugly trilogy, the Man with No Name trilogy, what those always boil down to is the gunfight, final one-on-one gunfight between the two people who stare each other down, and there's a lot of eye contact, there's a lot of back and forth, and it's a build-up and to lead-up, and then it's the shoot time. Like, that's what all those three-hour movies built up to. This one took that element in particular and made it the whole movie of just face-offs with each other, back and forth of who's going to win, who's going to come out on top. And because of that, and just because it is, you're absolutely right, Christine, it is corny, but it's a corny fun that I love, and Gene Hack automatically boosts it up a little bit. I'm giving this 4 stars.
Yeah, no, I love it. Yes, yeah, so this is like probably our biggest difference in ratings between the three people since we've had three people on here. Ends up at 3.25 average rating, which I think is completely fair for this movie. I guess since I said 3, I would think that is a good rating for this movie. I'd be like, oh yeah, it's perfect.
I agree.
I think that all three of our reactions and kind of our reviews to what we saw we're pretty valid here. So yeah, this was not what I expected when I saw this category come up. So I just want to thank you first and foremost for that. That I think it's a very outside the box recommendation for a pre-2000s Western, because it's not like there's movies in the 2000s done this way either. This was like only a movie that would have been done in the 90s the way it was.
Yes.
It was
has to be the 90s. Cannot have been made any other time.
Yeah, it's so 90s.
Because we've moved past that, like especially post-2000s Westerns. We've gone back to the grit. Yeah, we've gone back to the grittiness. There's no fun in any of the Westerns nowadays. So this was like really the epitome of it before. It's like gritty, 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 fun. Gritty, gritty, gritty. Like,
this is like the one fun like Western that I can really think. Yeah, it's like, and it definitely was that. So definitely credit there. We are going to have a guest on for next week, which is best Oscar's Best Picture winner, which was one we probably got more requests for than a lot of these. But we're going to have Scott Harvey coming on for that of the podcast Some Like It Scott, Champs Lunch over on Featured Presentation Productions page as well. It's a great Schmodown after show. Hopefully they get in the running for the award next year because they are awesome. But yeah, he's been one of our best contributors with regards to recommendations. Yes. And we appreciate all of our recommendations that we've had throughout this. So of course we took his recommendation and said, thanks, Scott. We've already seen that movie in Spotlight. So we're not going to talk about that, but we really want to talk about Slumdog Millionaire. Would you like to come on still? And he was like, of course I do. So Slumdog Millionaire is our selection for next week, directed by Danny Boyle. It's one that has been on Christine and I's watch list for a long time. When we started this podcast, it was one of the movies we said, we're going to talk about Slumdog Millionaire at some point. So we're taking the Best Picture winner. We're going to talk about it with Scott Harvey. So really, really excited to discuss that movie. I know the bare bones about it, but it's a movie that I have a feeling I am going to emotionally be very connected to and definitely resonate with. So I'm really excited to find out why so many people have loved this movie. It's a Best Picture winner, which doesn't always mean great things, Green Book, Crash, but you know, most of the time it does.
Yeah, but Dev Patel is pretty spectacular.
Yeah, and I love Danny Boyle as well. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to having Scott on. Always a great conversation. Before we leave, Jacoby, anything coming up for you that you want to let the people know about? I don't know, like there's a, if you're up to any sort of like Jeopardy. Have you been playing Jeopardy or any other shows of any kind?
Something like that. Funny that you mentioned that. I'm on this thing called the Schmodown, actually. I don't know if you've heard about it.
Oh.
Christina, you may have heard about it as well. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I've dabbled. I've dabbled.
I got a match coming up in the month of April.
Yes.
Check it out, where I face my doppelganger, Jacob Blunden, Jacoby Bancroft v. Jacob Blunden. Who's who? I don't even know. So be sure to check that out.
And I believe you're what, April 22nd?
Second. As far as I know, it's April 22nd.
Yeah. And, you know, we know those things change. So, yeah, definitely tune in a couple weeks from now for Jacoby. Overall, is there any other things that you'd like to plug?
I'm on Twitter at J. I'm just getting into this whole Twitter thing, I guess, is like a thing now. So it's like at JBancroft815 is my Twitter handle. Give me a follow and I'll follow back. I don't care. I'll follow anybody.
He is a follow back girl. He is a follow back girl. And to my follow back girl, Christina, anything coming up for you this week, or where can people find you?
No, I don't think I have anything coming up this week. I also want to do a plug for the free for all coming up, where maybe you'll see all of the Fan League Four. Maybe you'll see none of the Fan League Four. I don't know. I don't know who pops up, because we all know that it's just like 40 random people and we'll see how it goes. But I believe that's April 25th. But free for all is one of my favorite events the Schmodown puts on. So everybody take a look at that one, because that's always a lot of fun no matter what. You guys know you can follow me at Christina underscore VEE19. I don't even know my own thing. I don't, you know what? Whatever. Follow me, don't follow me. It is
look her up on IMDb. That's where you can find her. Yeah, you can find me. I'm also getting into this Twitter thing at Aaron J-A-Y Brooks. Half the time I'm talking cage fighting, half the time I'm talking movies. It is the same person though. I just have my two obsessions. But also, if you're listening this far in, first of all, thank you, Billy, and whoever else made it this far into the podcast. Definitely check out Peggy Govan's match last week if you hadn't already. I'm really glad to see the reaction that's had. We're always rooting for her, former guest here with Long Shot as well. So yeah, check out all my talented friends who are more talented than me and more likable than me, which is why they're in a position I'll never be in on the Schmodown. But for Aaron, for Christina, for Jacoby, keep being quick and keep digesting cinema. Hopefully alive. That really worked out well. All right. Have a good one, everybody. Take care.